Throughout 2025, we've seen a great deal of federal focus on public health, from chemical hazards to federal agency cuts. But what does all this really mean to the food industry? I'm your host. I'm Lisa Lupo, your host of TAG Talks Food Safety. Today I'm welcoming TAG COO and EVP of Regulatory and Scientific Affairs, Dr. Benjamin Miller. Ben holds a Master of Public Health in Epidemiology and a PhD in Environmental Health with a background in infectious diseases. So we'll be discussing the current trends in public health and what they mean for the food industry with Ben's expertise. So welcome, Ben.
Great to be with you as always, Lisa.
It's always good to have you on. So, there really has been a lot of federal focus placed on chemical hazards in foods in recent months. Can you discuss what has been happening and why?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we actually saw kind of a shift in the agency's focus, even starting kind of in the previous administration. So they FDA had started having kind of internal meetings and conversations back in the summer of 2024. And a lot of what we've seen, I think, was also of interest to the new administration, especially as it relates to chemical hazards. I think we've seen public interest in terms of what are some of the chemicals that are in people's food. And we've certainly seen social media influencers out there kind of talking about, concerns about just things like heavy metals, certainly around infant and baby food, but even more broadly than that, in terms of what are some potential hazards and risks. And we've certainly seen some states take individual action around like colors and dyes. We'll probably talk about that in a little bit. But it has been a bit of a sea change, which is kind of interesting and unique. In the US, we've really been focused, I think, from a food safety standpoint about around kind of micro and biological hazards. And in some ways, I think that was driven by the fact that, if you have a foodborne illness outbreak, it's easy if you've got a surveillance system in place to detect it, right? People eat food, a couple of days later, they get sick. We don't really have that same type of surveillance system for chemical hazards. And even if we did, some of the risks that come from chemical hazards are more long term, right? So we did see back in 2023 and 2024 some acute of adverse events associated with consumption of applesauce pouches that have been contaminated with lead due to the cinnamon in the ingredient being contaminated for economic adulteration reasons. So, but typically we don't see chemical hazards show up that way. And so the way that we've thought about and regulated chemical hazards and risks in the US has been a little different. I think you compare that to the EU, where the regulatory stance is more on the precautionary principle. We want to assume that something is not going, we want to build systems that will prevent potential harm versus maybe our regulatory stance here in the US historically around chemical hazards in particular has been more around risk assessment and probably being a little more liberal in terms of defining some of those limits. So I think there's been a lot of conversation about what is safe, what's the safe amount of, a heavy metal, for example, in an ingredient or a finished product. Well, that really depends on the population that you're talking about. And so there's a lot of sort of toxicological work that needs to go and figure out and answer that question. And sometimes I think because those are hard questions to answer, we haven't ended up with those same limits that we see in markets like the EU. So in a little kind of subtle way, we've let the perfect be the enemy of the good. I think when we're kind of trying to figure out how we want to think about characterizing chemical risk. So long answer, but I think, the reasons why are sort of multifactorial, but I also think the consuming public, there's a growing awareness and concern about just what's in my food, and I want to know and make sure that what I'm consuming is ultimately safe, that it's not going to cause issues for me, in the medium to long term.
So, how is that focus and even the consumer awareness really, how is all that impacting the food industry and its regulatory environment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was just today at the FSPCA conference giving a talk on that very subject in terms of how do we think about sort of assessing chemical hazards and what are some of the resources that are available to assess chemical hazards for the food industry. So I think both the interest kind of in the new administration, what we think of as kind of the MAHA movement to some extent, has driven more awareness around that and more thinking about hazard analysis and risk assessment. So what do I need to think about in terms of chemical hazards that can either come from my ingredient supply or that might show up as part of my own manufacturing process, or that might show up as a part of the manufacturing process of the ingredients that I have. And so just interestingly enough, having some conversations with industry today on that very topic. So I think there's been a shift and change in mindset and where people are starting to understand, we need to dig a little deeper here. The other side of that coin too is that FDA did update Appendix One, which is kind of that risk or hazard identification table, set of tables that, traditionally we've thought of for biological hazards, although chemical hazards have always been there. But they updated that at the end of 2024, and some new kind of product chemical hazard associations started to stand out. So I think that also has driven industry to go look and say, well, we see this in Appendix One. Is this really a hazard, or does that hazard constitute a risk in the way that we're making finished product? So the short answer is it's caused people to start looking and thinking more about how do we answer that question, especially as it relates to, is it a hazard in what I make? And then if it is it a risk to the consumer and the end product?
So if we look at even like kind of the bigger picture of public health, a lot of the federal cuts of 2025 have impacted the public health agencies. CDC lost about 3,000 jobs, FDA lost about 3,500. And if passed, the HHS proposed FY26 budget would reduce CDC funding by $5 billion, which could put even more jobs at risk. So how is that impacting public health overall? Or do you
Yeah,
see it
I mean
potentially?
it is, and I think, for a long time the federal government was, I think you could say, an employer of choice. It's where people that had an interest in public health and science really went. That might be the pinnacle of their career, or they would get there and stay for 20, 30 years. I think that's changed in terms of the way that people view that. Now, that's not to say, I mean, there's plenty of good people still at those agencies, thankfully. And some have left. Some we've had the fortunate tag to, benefit from people that wanted a change in opportunity. And so that expertise hasn't really left the food safety landscape necessarily. It maybe moved to other places. I think one of the longer term challenges, though, is like as you look at and build that next generation of people that are interested in public health, is that going to be where they go? And so what's sort of the long-term impact to agency expertise? I think CDC is an entirely sort of different story. I think we're seeing backlash in a lot of ways from the COVID pandemic and, certain, desires to not have restrictions placed on, activities in the future, even though, in hindsight, it's always 2020, right? Like I think, if we rewound time to March of 2020, it's probably a good idea that people were staying at home. And we didn't know, right? Well, this was a new disease, like it was a new pandemic. We didn't know the extent of the level of illness it would cause. And when we won't know that for the next one too, when it happens, So I think we tend to view that kind of in a Monday morning quarterback position. I think CDC in particular is going to struggle in terms of just recruiting and maintaining talent that's going to want to especially focus on areas like infectious disease and vaccine preventable diseases and things like that, which I think is unfortunate. I think we're going to have to learn some of these lessons over again. And I hate to say that, but I think that's kind of where we are. Like,
And during that time, there was a lot of communication put out. Like you said, some of it we learned it wasn't right or initially, but eventually tried to get everything right. But so the cuts are also impacting that, the amount of communication that these health agencies can put out. So consumers are turning to the media, the social media influencers for news and even for health guidance. So what do you see that having an effect?
yeah, I mean, I think There's always been sort of a strain of anti-intellectualism, I think, throughout American history. And we kind of have that ebbs and flows, right? You came out of World War II, and I think there was a lot of desire to sort of build a science-based economy, and you had many people going to college for the first time and then going to graduate school. And, we built a bunch of infrastructure. We sent somebody to the moon, right? Like, so we made all these sort of science-based investments. And then at the same time, when things work, when systems function well, people forget why they work well, and I think that's true anytime you're talking about a prevention-based system. It's something we struggle with in food safety all the time, right? It's telling the story of why food safety isn't a cost center. It's actually essentially insurance. It's saving you money in the long run. It's preventing things from happening. So, I think it's societally and frankly, through the spread of social media, I think, people have access to platforms that they haven't had access to in the past, right? And so somebody's opinion can seem as valid as the person that went and did 8 years researching a particular topic and holds a PhD in that field. And, for a certain audience, the person's opinion matters more than the research that supports it. I think the reality is, though, is that, science being what it is, and sort of just nature being what it is, like we ultimately end up back at that, source of
That's right.
truth, right? Like we can have all the opinions we want, like, but Mother Nature kind of wins at the end of the day. So, I think turning your back or turning our collective back on science, in the short term or even the medium term is going to yield particularly unfortunate results. Then, but it might have to be the lesson that we have to collectively learn over again. Again, I hate to say that, but I mean,
Yeah.
it's a little bit of where we are.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, shifting gears a little bit, we're also seeing an increase in the use of AI, which, I mean, it probably could help supplement some of those job losses. And overall, it does increase innovation and operational efficiencies. But how do you see it being used in the area of public health? Or how could it be used even if it's not yet?
Yeah, I think it's important. You talked about data in your previous question. I didn't really answer that portion of your question, but this is a good time to do that. All of these systems, any AI system is really built on having good data, right? So if we're not capturing some of the sort of fundamental surveillance or core public health data that we've been able to capture in the past, like the ability to feed that information into any AI system. And I'm going to, talk about AI just in the broad context of not just ChatGPT, but, a system trained for a specific outcome. That might be a system that's trained to predict when the next, influenza surge and illness is going to be, or when, and so there are different ways to use data to predict outcomes. I sat through a session around, the way that FDA is using inspection data and an AI model to sort of predict where to go inspect, because that's where you're more likely to find violations. But again, all of that's predicated on having good data. And so if we really kind of cut back the infrastructure around data collection, I think that does hamstring us. I think too, you still need people to validate the conclusions that come out of these models. So you have to have people who are knowledgeable in those areas essentially to interpret the output of any model, right? So, you can go pick your favorite large language model today, and start to type stuff in, and eventually you're going to find it's telling you something that's wrong, and it's going to
Right.
confidently tell you that thing is, it's not going to tell you that it's wrong. It's just going to confidently state what it thinks, or whatever it's returning in terms of statistical probabilities. And so getting away from expertise, I think, is still dangerous. We need that expertise, throughout all of the disciplines in science, and like you said, AI is going to be able to augment the speed at which some of that research is done. But ultimately, you're still going to need people to go convince other people that the output of a model is a good idea, and that's where science and politics tend to, which is a can be a challenging space sometimes.
Can be, certainly can. So, what other trends are you seeing in public health overall?
Yeah, I mean, I think, we touched a little bit on vaccine preventable diseases. I think, we have seen an erosion in sort of the desire for certain groups to want to go get vaccinated, which I think is, going to set us up maybe for some. We've already seen that in the case of measles in some parts of the US and Canada. So I think, just some of those core public health functions are still going to be something we need to be attentive to. HPAI is another issue that, kind of has percolated. It's percolated in the background for the past year and a half or two. That's something that, again, we want to make sure we've got surveillance systems in place that if something does shift or change, that we're not facing a situation like we did with COVID. And the concern or fear around something like HPAI might be, instead of, 1% mortality rate, you're up to a 10 or 15 or 20% mortality rate at the beginning. So you can imagine what that would be like, and I think that's definitely a scenario we want to collectively avoid. So we need systems, we need people. I think that's kind of the thread that you're picking up here, systems, data, people, expertise. And I think, trust in those systems. So part of it's just getting out there and telling the story. We're doing that as part of this Tag Talk. For the few hundred people that might watch this, that's great. Share with a friend. But I think that's the point, right? Like, we need to sometimes have these conversations, acknowledge where we are, and then people need to say, well, this is important enough to me, like in my professional life, that I'm gonna continue to try to fight the good fight, whatever that looks like, in their capacity.
You did mention MAHA a little bit, the Make America Healthy Again. How does this fit in with that? How does the focus of the current administration on that.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's interesting because I think, you look back over the last sort of 20 years of public health, especially around nutrition, and there have been, voices, I think what you would say is on more of the progressive side of the political spectrum, that have talked about, nutrition and childhood nutrition and, just formulation, ultra processed food, like how much is a safe amount? What should we be feeding kids? What does that mean in the context of the obesity crisis? So, I think interestingly, that's become, I think the MAHA movement's kind of recentered that more to, I guess I'd say, the political center at this point. You've got a variety of people interested in that topic. And I think there's a lot of reasons to think that pursuing some of those policies from a broader public health standpoint and nutrition standpoint, it's a good idea, right? Like, we know obesity is a problem, and we know that there are many comorbidities associated with obesity, like hypertension, stroke, heart disease, cancer. So these are all things that essentially drive up medical costs in the US. And so there's many knock-on effects. So, I hope this is more than just sort of a moment in the sun for some of these issues, but a lot of it really depends on, too, I think, then making it a serious commitment to look at nutritional policy and then putting the resources behind those things, because wishing won't make it so, right? And I think we've seen sort of flashes of willingness to have some conversations that, frankly, government hasn't been willing to have around kind of nutritional policy, but that really hasn't manifested itself yet in terms of policy. So I think we're kind of in a wait and see period at this point. And we'll see.
So I think, boy, with all this, you've certainly given us a lot to think about. But if you take a look at just all that we've talked about, what would you see as kind of key points, just a few key points that you want the food industry to take away from all this?
Yeah, I think you're going to need to continue to invest in expertise. AI is dependent on data. Food safety data is pretty fragmented at this point, so I don't know that that's going to be an easy pivot into developing more mature systems for the food industry right now. So I think if that's a direction that people want to head, that you have to think about collecting good, standardized, digitized data. If you're going to try to build and use these tools, but you can't really get around the fact that you want to have access to expertise in that space as well. And I think, yeah, again, to where we started at the top, being attentive to some of these newer hazards and chemical risks, like what does that mean? Like, and doing more of a deep dive. I think one of the things that we've seen over the last 10 or 15 years too within the food industry is kind of stepping back from having toxicological or toxicologists in-house. So that expertise, by and large, now I think resides, in academia and probably even more so in consulting at this point. We're fortunate to have Dr. Joe Semenka, the toxicologist with us, with our team. I've learned a lot from Joe over the last few years, but I think, making sure that you have access to people that understand toxicology, especially in the context of assessing chemical risk, is going to be important over the next 3 to 5 years for sure. That's a big one.
Thank you so much, Ben. It's, I want to also thank our audience for listening in and hope that we've given you some new insights on the trends in public health and just overall what's happening today. So,
Absolutely.
yes. And as always, to stay informed on all things food safety and ensure that you don't miss any episodes of Tag Talks Food Safety, be sure to like, follow, or subscribe to us on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, or whatever your favorite podcast is. Thanks, Ben.
Hey, thanks, Lisa. It's a pleasure.